Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Kabbalah and Coffee. So today we have a fascinating discussion that continues our theme about relationships and love and intimacy and connections and really how to build any type of relationship in a healthy way. So I just want to go back to something, to a theme that we've spoken about before, and that is how we understand the word love. Right? How do we understand the word love? And here's how I want to frame it. Anytime we use the word love, and what we mean is that after this encounter, only one of us will exist, that can't be love. Right? In other words, if there's a love experience, and after that experience, only one party, one of the two, is still in existence, that's not actually true love. And what I mean is, using my example that we've used before, the idea of person says, I love chocolate, or I love sushi, or I love a good wine, right? If after that encounter, if after that experience, the only thing left is you, and the chocolate is gone, right? If the only thing left is you, and the glass is empty because the wine is drunk, if the only thing left is you, and the sushi, and a little bit of soy sauce at the bottom, but the rest of the sushi is finished, then that cannot be love in the truest sense. Love cannot mean that at the end of that experience, only one has survived and the other one has been consumed. That's not love. You don't have two parties anymore. So love is really, it's not about consuming the other, but it's connecting deeply with the other. And that's why, you know, throughout this study of this book, I've tried to use also the word intimacy, which I think implies more of a connection as opposed to a consumption, if you will. Love can be very consuming. Love can be very selfish or self-oriented. And intimacy can also. But I think intimacy is a word that we might be able to use to just shake things up a little bit from the word of love, to connote the idea of two parties truly connecting and coming together in a deep way. The question is, and this is a question that's been driving our discussion, even if it hasn't been driving it overtly and it was on the surface, it's been driving it on a deep level. The question is, how do you build a truly deep connection with someone else? How do you really build that connection? How to be obsessed about someone? Okay, you don't need a manual for that. How to consume something? Hey, again, we don't need a manual for that, right? You love yourself, you like how it tastes, you're going to eat the, you're going to drink the wine. That we don't need a discussion. But how do you really connect deeply with another being? Not with chocolate, but with another human being. How do you have a deep relationship? Whether it's a spouse, or a child, or a parent, or a friend, or whoever it is. Anyone that you want to have a deep connection with. How do you create a deep connection? So in our text, we've been describing this, I think, in an incredible way. In order to have a deep connection, you have to do the little things, the million little things that create the smaller connections. In other words, if you really want to have a deep connection with someone else, you have to do the small things that set the stage for that deeper connection. You can't just expect to have a deeper connection and jump right in to have a very close relationship with somebody. It has to be a process that is a step-by-step process of doing the little things. So, for example, the example that we gave in this discourse itself, the mystical example of a teacher and a student. And we said, and he quotes the Talmud. So the Talmud says that Rabbah, the great Talmudic teacher Rabbah, before he would begin teaching, he would open his discourse with a joke. He would begin with an item of humor. And after the joke, then he would begin teaching. So we were analyzing this, and we said, why the joke? If the intention is to impart within his students some deep wisdom of Jewish law or Jewish ethics or values, if the idea is to impart wisdom and knowledge, so why the joke? It's a distraction. It's like you're it's a different class. That's comedy 101. What's with why the comedy in middle of this, or at the, even at the beginning of this conversation? So he says that you can't jump right into the lesson. You can't jump right in without the small talk, without the joke, without something to break the ice. You can't forge a deep connection unless you do the little things that make the connection. So this is a very important message, not only for teaching, not only, and it's true in any relationship. Anytime you want to have a connection, you have to do the little things that comprise, that forge that bond. Because if love and if intimacy is about connection, then you have to build a connection to have the connection. You can't expect the connection to be there naturally or, you know, somehow organically. And the connection is not going to be there unless the little things are done. Sometimes it's easier to do the little things. Sometimes it's harder. When I say sometimes it's harder, it's like I should still do the little things. Like, why should I? Like, little things have been done already. I still need to do the little things? The answer is yes. Yes. If you wish to maintain a connection, a deep connection, you can't have the deep connection without the thousand little things. So I'll tell you a story. Story goes that there was once a young man, a newlywed, who came to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And he was speaking with him, you know, advice and other things. And he said, I heard that folding the talit Saturday night is a segula, is a, you translate segula. Segula is like a merit or a good omen for shalom bayit, for peace in the home, for a happy marriage. So let me explain. This young man was saying that he heard, somebody told him, or he read somewhere. So, let me take a half a step back. So, if you look in the back of the synagogue, we have the talitim, the prayer shawls, right, folded up over there. So, the custom is that on Shabbat, many have the custom not to fold the talit. Why? There's one of the 39 areas of work, one of the related areas of prohibited work, although it doesn't seem like a lot of work, is folding something on creases. So you try not to fold something on pre-existing creases. So if you have garments that have a fold, so we make an effort not to fold it on that actual crease. Why? In tabernacle times, that's one of the things that they did. They folded things or they, whatever. So we try to avoid folding. So many people, Shabbat, after services, Shabbat morning after services, will not fold the talit perfectly, kind of just, you know, put it into a little bit of a pile, and then Saturday night, fold the talit. The question is, do you fold it Saturday night after Shabbat, or maybe Sunday morning? You know, if you're pushing it off anyway, why not Sunday morning? So this young man said to the Rebbe, I heard that if you fold your talit Saturday night, then it is a segula, it's a good omen. Four, it's like a good, it's more than an omen. Omen is like a sign. It's more than a sign. It's like, it creates, it's a good energy for shalom bayit, for peace in the home. The Rebbe responded the following, and this is unbelievable. He said, I've never heard that. I don't know about folding the talit, but what I do know is if you fold up your sleeves and help your wife wash the dishes Saturday night, that's definitely a good omen. That's definitely a good segula, a good vibe, whatever it is, for shalom bayit, for peace in the home. Practical, right? Fold the talit, yeah, maybe. Somewhere spiritually, you know, you fold the talit, it's going to magically create peace in the home. Rebbe says, I don't know about that, but I'll tell you one thing. Fold your sleeves, roll up your sleeves, and do the dishes.
Which is probably the little stuff.
That's the little stuff. It's the little stuff. You want to have a loving relationship with your spouse? Are you doing the little things? So Leah tells me a story. She says she forgot the details already, but she heard this story where there was also a young, newly married fellow who was speaking to his rabbi, you know, for advice, obviously confidentially, and he says, you know, my wife doesn't seem to be happy. I don't know why, this and that. I'm trying all these things, but she doesn't seem to be happy. And so I think the punchline, I don't know exactly the details, and she didn't remember all the details, but she told me something to the effect of, so the rabbi drives over to this fellow's house and takes out the garbage. I mean, something like something as simple as that. I know it's maybe a little too stereotypical about taking out the garbage, but the point is, the point is, connections are made through the little things. That's how we make it. Connections are forged through the little things that we do. If we want deep connections, the question is, are we putting in the effort in areas that might seem to be off topic? It might seem like, what is doing the dishes have to do with feeling close with the person I love, right? We're in a relationship. We've pledged to love each other. So doing the dishes, yeah, doing the dishes. Telling a joke is going to help my students learn. Yeah, it's going to help. It's going to help. It's the little things that seem to be a distraction from the main point. Sometimes those little things, you can't have the main point without the little things. So this is an important message it's an important lesson to remember in life in any relationship that we want, whether it's a relationship with a loved one or with a coworker or with a boss or with an employee. You know, if you want a relationship, the question is, what are you doing? What are the little things that you're doing to set the stage for that deeper relationship? And the idea is that you can, and using the language of the discourse, you can't have an inner, using the language here, you can't have an inner relationship unless you have an outer relationship. You can't have a deep relationship without having a more shallow relationship. Even though it might seem shallow, it's not shallow at all, but it might seem to you as being something so shallow, so distracting, so petty, so non-essential. And the point is, you can't have a deeper connection without the more shallow things. In other words, if you wait, if you don't do the little things, you can't expect for that bigger connection to be there. Right? If we don't put in the daily effort doing the little things and the little acknowledgments and the little thank yous and the little acts of love and care and concern and respect and etc., then there won't be a bigger connection. There won't be the deeper connection that without the little stuff. Make sense? So getting back to the discourse, he's giving two examples of scenarios where something more external leads to something much more internal. Something more shallow leads to something that is much deeper. The first example, as I mentioned, which we've discussed a few weeks ago in our last session, the first example was the rabbi and the joke. So Rabba is teaching. Before he teaches, he tells a joke, he breaks the ice. It's the little things that forge the deeper connection. And once you have the little things in place, then you can go in and teach and really connect on a deeper way. By the way, teaching, just so you know, before we move on into the new information, to the new text, teaching is not just about imparting wisdom. It's much more than that. Teaching is seen to be akin to planting a seed, where you're not just giving, it's not just you're putting a seed into the ground and the seed stays in the ground, but rather the seed can then flourish and blossom and produce a whole tree or a whole plant or whatever it is, life and arena of growth, and that can produce more fruit that has its own seeds and carry on this cycle of life. So teaching is understood to be akin to planting a seed, where you not only give information, but you plant a seed that can germinate and then blossom. And a really good teacher, when teaching a student, so the student can subsequently unpack the information and it can guide them in life. So we're talking about a very deep experience. The student, though, has to be open to it. If the student is not really listening and not really integrating it, then it's not going to be a seed that germinates. In other words, you have to plant a seed. If you want the seed to grow, the ground has to be fertile. The ground has to be, you can't plant a seed on concrete. It's not going to work. Right? You put a seed in the parking lot here, I don't know, probably nothing's going to happen. That's my guess. So the earth has to be prepared. And the idea is that Rabba, when he told the joke, so that opened up the students, it broke the ice. And now he can not only teach, but he can plant seeds of wisdom. And those seeds can flourish and blossom and grow. And his students can become teachers. That's the ultimate goal. that the student becomes a teacher, and maybe an even greater teacher than their teacher. That's the goal. I'm thinking about trees nowadays. In front of our house, like a block and a half away, we have a peach tree and a plum tree. Man, those things are throwing down fruit. Yeah. We must have had like 300-400 peaches on that tree. Yeah. Legit.
What do you do with all those?
So the kids have been picking as many. We have like a fruit picker. Like one of those poles. We've been picking as many as we can. Some the squirrels get to. Some fall down and kind of like, you know, smash on the ground. Some fall in the yard. Whatever we can pick and it's good, we put them in bags and leave them out for the neighbors. Yeah. It's a lot of peaches. It's a ton of peaches. But now the plums are falling, and that's a disaster. Yeah, because it's very high, so we can't reach them, and they're falling, and they're softer. Yeah. We need something. We need like some sort of, yeah, that's not a bad, yeah. Whatever they use in the circus to like do one of those nets somewhere. Okay, so let's jump into the new text. Everyone has a copy? Yes? Page 36. Actually, no, sorry. It's not at all the page we're up to. Page 38. Second example. I should mention there's a second discourse in this book. One is the previous Rebbe's discourse said at the Rebbe's wedding. And the other one is the Rebbe's discourse that he said 25 years later on his 25th anniversary, where he gives an explanation of his father-in-law's discourse. You with me? So you have the original discourse said at the Rebbe's own wedding by his father-in-law, his future father-in-law. And then you have the Rebbe's explanation of this discourse 25 years later after his father-in-law had already passed away. Actually, 4 years after his father-in-law passed away. 25 on his 25th anniversary. Not necessarily on his 25th anniversary, but 25 years later. When did he say it? Hold on. Let me see if it was on the anniversary. No, it wasn't on the anniversary itself. But anyway, he explained the discourse, and he explains why the first discourse, which is the one we're studying, why he brings two examples of the little things that bring to the big things. But here's the second example. But he analyzes what each example brings. Good morning, good morning. So 38. Pass down one more copy. Oh, you have? Okay, great. Thanks. Okay, page 38, and we're at the section that starts with a father's love. And he brings a second example. Take, for example, a father who wishes to play with his very young son face to face. So imagine a parent that wants to have a connection with a child. Since the child is small, the father must lower his hands, which are normally above the child's head, until they are underneath the child, and then he must pick up the child until the child is at the same level as his head. Now, this sounds like a very mechanical explanation of a parent lifting up a child, right? Picking up a kid. But this is literally what he's saying. He's saying the parent is tall, is higher, the child is smaller, the parent's hands, even, you know, lowered, are still higher than the young child's head. The parent has to reach down, put the hands underneath the child, and lift up the child until the child is at the same level as his head. Only then can the father speak with his child and play with him face to face. So if you want that deep connection, you first have to have a more external action of picking up the child. So in this example, page 40, in this example, the father's act of kindness in lowering his hands is a completely external expression of the father's connection with his son. He does this just to pick up the child. In other words, the parent wants to connect with the child face to face on whatever deep level of connection the parent is wishing to have with the child at this moment. That's the intended connection. But in order to get that, the parent has to reach down and lift up the child. Most of us have never disassociated the lifting up the child, the picking up of a baby, with that face-to-face interaction, right? Getting the child to smile, right? So you lift up the baby, and now you can have that face-to-face contact. We don't think about the process of lifting up the baby. The question is like this. What's the design? What's the intent? What's the intention here? The intention here is to connect face to face with the child. It's not to pick up the child, but in order to connect face to face, since the child is lower, you have to pick up the child. Does it make sense? It almost sounds like we're analyzing like a football play here. Like, look how that guy moved it. But the point is, the mechanics of it are important in this context. Because you're doing something that is not the that's not the intent. The intent is not to pick up the child. The intent is to connect face to face. But you can't connect face to face without lowering your hands to pick up the child. And a person might say, I'm not a lowering the hands type of person. I'm a face-to-face type of guy. I'll have it, once you're here, I'll have a connection with you. I'm not going to do the lower work of picking up, of lifting something up. The point is, if you don't do the work lifting up the child, you're not going to have that face-to-face contact. Without doing the little things, the things that might seem to be beneath you, for example, the fellow who said to the Rebbe in the story that I told you, that I heard that if I fold my talit Saturday night, it's going to magically somehow, you know, create good vibes in the relationship. And the Rebbe said, I don't know about folding your talit, but fold up your sleeves and do the dishes, and that will definitely help your relationship, right? So that point is telling this person, you're not above doing the dishes. And it might seem to you like a lower mundane activity. It's a lower mundane activity. It's like, if I fold the talit, fold a prayer shawl, it's a mitzvah, it's a holy item, it's a ritual item, right? You can't just throw out a talit after you're done with it. If it's no longer kosher, you have to bury it, you have to discard it with honor, and you don't just, you know, it's like, so something holy, I get, it can have an impact, it's a, but something so mundane, lowering my hands into a sink full of dirty dishes, that's gonna heal my, that's gonna help my relationship? Yeah. You need to do the little things in order to have the deeper connections. So you want to have a connection with your child. Are you lowering your hands? It's not only with babies, with young children. It's true on every level. You want to have a deep connection with your kid? The question is, are you doing the little things to keep up those, to keep up that communication, to have the bigger conversations? You can't have a deeper connection without doing the little things day in, day out that foster that relationship. So you say, yeah, but my child should be old enough where we should be able to have the deeper conversations without the little stuff. Just have a conversation. We should have this mutual respect after all these years, etc. The point is, like the young child, you want to have that connection. You may have to lower your hands and do something that seems to be a distraction in order to get that conversation started. In other words, doing the little things is critical to having the deeper connection. Again, this is a truth in every area of life, at least in every relationship area of life. Whatever you want in this relationship, whatever your desire is, think, how am I going to get there? And then think and be open to the possibility, to the reality that it's going to take a million small things, I don't mean literally a million, but many, many small things in order to get to the bigger connection. It's not just going to happen. And even if it's happened before, in order for that deep connection to be maintained, it still takes day in, day out, all the little things, the little sacrifices, the little acts of giving, the little acts of consideration, right? The little acts of telling the joke and lift and bending down and picking up the child. Again, these are metaphorical ideas, but these are the little things in life that build that, that set the stage for that deeper connection. Does it make sense? Okay. Page 40, second paragraph. So he just said that for the parent, lifting, bending down and putting the hands under the child to lift the child up, that's not what the child that's not what the parent wants. The parent wants that face-to-face connection. But to get there, you have to bend down and lift up the child. He says, furthermore, second paragraph, the child also does not receive anything from the actual act of the father lifting him, as there is no giving on the father's part yet. In other words, that face-to-face contact, in the act of picking up the child, that's not happening yet. So the act of lifting the child is totally a preparatory action that sets the stage for that connection. The parent's not getting anything out of lifting up the child. The child, he says here, is also not getting anything on a deeper level out of being lifted up by the parent. It's solely doing something in order to get something else. Straight up. It's doing one thing to set the stage for something much deeper. And again, it might seem like a distraction. It might seem like, if I want face-to-face time, so then let me work on that. Why am I working on lifting up the child? The point is, you can't get that without that. Simply, let's continue. Middle paragraph, second line. The father only gives... Maybe I already read this, I don't remember. The father only gives to his child later, after he has lifted the child and actually begins playing with him. So again, the connection happens after the lifting. The lifting, the father is not really giving, the child is not really receiving, and yet it's needed in order to have that deeper connection. Simply, it is impossible for there to be the close, deep interaction between father and child without the child first being raised. This is the external connection that precedes and enables the deeper internal connection. So as we close out chapter 2, what we've learned is this incredible process by which relationships and really, you know, intimate relationships, an intimate connection where intimacy is formed. And it's formed not by the big things, but it's by the small things. Intimate connections with somebody else, an intimate relation with somebody else, is forged through the small things. I don't think it's any surprise that the Hebrew word that's used, or the biblical term that's used for intimacy, at least for the act of intimacy, is da'at, which means knowledge. It's about knowing, right? And Adam knew Eve, and she conceived and bore a child. So he knew her, but he knew, like... But knowing implies the little things that it takes to really get to know somebody. Right, it's all of the little things to really get to know the other person. We all know the phrase, God is in the details, and it's true. The little details are not so little; they're very important. Okay, so let's jump into chapter 3. For chapter 3, you need a brand new booklet, which I have conveniently ready to go. Okay, so let's pass these around. Chapter 3, what he does, and let me explain the process here. What we're going to do now is take a look at how all of this is paralleled in our relationship with God. In other words, this is not just true of interpersonal relationships, where in order to have a deep relationship, you have to set the stage with all the little things, and you have to kind of lower down oneself to connect on a more external level to have that deeper connection. The same thing is true vis-a-vis us and God. God does the same thing for us. Do the more external things that lead to the deeper connections. Thank you. Okay, so chapter 3, page 42. He says, this is the meaning of the verse from the prophet Hosea, I don't know how you pronounce it in English. I guess it's Hosea, but in the Hebrew it's Hosea. So the verse says, I sent to Ephraim and took them upon my arms. This is God speaking. And Ephraim, who's Ephraim? Ephraim is one of the 12 tribes. Ephraim is not one of the original 12 sons of Yaakov, but Ephraim is one of the two sons of Yosef. So Ephraim is counted as one of the 12 tribes because the tribe of Levi is not counted. Whatever. Point is, Ephraim here is symbolic. It's euphemistic of the entire Jewish people. So the verse says again, God says, I sent to Ephraim and took them upon my arms. In other words, I lifted up the Jewish people, God says. I lifted up, I took them upon my arms. It's like a parent that lifts up a child, taking them in their arms. We just gave the example that how do you have a deep connection with a child? By lifting them up. And now he's quoting a verse where God says, I lifted up the Jewish people. What does that mean, I lifted up? Let's jump in. Kabbalah explains, the one who is called, I am who I am. Remember when Moses asked God by the burning bush? God says to Moses, I want you to be the one to go to Pharaoh and facilitate this whole Exodus situation. I'm paraphrasing. It's not exactly what he said. Right? Go to Pharaoh, tell him, let my people go, etc. And Moses says, no, not me. You got the wrong guy. I don't want to do it. I'm too humble. All that stuff. At some point, Moses says to God, when I come to the Jewish people and I tell them that you sent me, they're going to ask, who sent you? So what's your name? He asks God. What's your name? And God says, Ehye Asher Ehye. I will be what I will be. Or I am who I am. I mean, different translations. But the connotation is that God is saying, I exist beyond any names. You want a name? You're not going to get a name out of me. There are names of God, but God, in essence, is beyond names. Let's explain this for another moment. Each one of us here has a name. You have a name that you were given. You have a name that people call you. It might be a little bit different. My full name, my given name, my Hebrew name, is Yehuda Aryeh. Yehuda Aryeh. Both names actually mean lion. Yehuda and Aryeh are Hebrew words for lion. I'm called by my middle name, but by an abbreviated version of my middle name. So we all have names. The names that we were given, maybe the name, the modification that we're called. The point is like this. If you exist, if you live on a remote desert island, and it's just you, it's you and a volleyball. Kidding. Wilson, right? It's just you and Wilson. No, it's just you. Not even Wilson. Just you. Do you need a name? Do you require a name? See, most of us understand a name to have a very utilitarian purpose. If somebody wants to call you and differentiate you from others in a room or others in the world, so you have a name. A first name, a last name. It gets confusing sometimes when people in the same room share the same name. So for example, in Crown Heights, at the, you know, in the heart of the Chabad community, thousands of Chabad families live there. And imagine the boys' school. Imagine in any given class how many Menachem Mendels you have. That was people named their kids after the Rebbe, right? Menachem Mendel. Our second son is named Mendel. Menachem Mendel, called Mendel. So there's Mendel, Mendy, Menachem, Meni. What other terms? Menach, Manny, right? All these different types of nicknames to differentiate some kids. At some point, they just go by last names, right? Cohen, Goldberg, Greenberg, Iceberg. No, I'm kidding. That's that's that other joke. So they go by last names. But the point is that most of us understand that the purpose of a name for other people. In other words, I don't need a name, but you need me to have a name. If I'm alone, I don't need a name. I am I. I don't need a name to know who I am. You need a name to have a handle on who I am. I don't need a name for myself. You with me on this? Make sense? Again, if you were just you alone, if there was no one else around, do you still need a name? You don't need a name. Others, so Kabbalah teaches, a name is really for others. Now, a name also channels the divine energy into your soul and reflects the contours of the energy that enlivens your soul, and all of that is true. But at its core, a name is really for the other. A name is really so that others can identify you. So when it comes to God, Kabbalah teaches that the names of God reflect God's energy in relation to otherness. In other words, as God exists relative to the universe, God has a name. Because we need to call God a certain way, we need to relate to God. So once we exist, so God assumes the form of names so that we have a way of relating to God. So God's names are for us. Just like our names are for others, we don't need a name for ourselves. So too, God's names are for otherness. Once you have the existence of creation, heaven and earth, universe, whether it's an angel or a soul or a human being, whatever it is, once you have otherness, others, so now God needs, I can't really say need, God doesn't need anything, but once you have others, God assumes the form of a name as well. Which is why Kabbalah says that even the highest name is not reflective perfectly of God's essential essence. God's pure essence is I, beyond any name. Even the name, the four-letter name of God that we don't pronounce, the Yod-Kei Vav-Kei name of God, the four-letter name, which I'm not even, we don't even pronounce the letters K. There's no letter K in Hebrew. It's Hey. But we don't even say the letter Hey. Even we don't, you with me on this? We don't pronounce this name of God as it's written. We don't even say the letters in sequence the way the letters are. Yod, the closest I can say it is Yod, followed by Hey, followed by Vav, followed by Hey. But when you say it together, it's Yod K Vav K. We don't even say it. So it's the ineffable name. It's the name that cannot be pronounced. It's so high, and yet it's not the essence. Because any name reflects a step down from the essence. It's how I exist, not within myself, but relative to you. So relative to you, I need a name. Relative to myself, I don't need a name. So whenever the Torah uses the phrase I, referring to God, it means the essence. Anytime it says a name, it's lower than the essence. You should know that the four-letter name of God is called the essential name of God. Essential, but it's the essential name of God. In other words, it's not the essence, it's the highest of the names. The deepest name, but a name is still El Hazulat. It's still to someone else. It's not for oneself. So when the verse says in Hosea, I sent to Ephraim and took them upon my arms. Who's saying this? God? God's a name. I, the essence of all, is saying, I took them upon my arms. I lifted them up. So that's the second paragraph. Let's do that again. The one who is called, I am who I am. Anochi misha anochi. I am who I am, i.e. God himself. Beyond names, lowered his innermost will specifically into physical mitzvot, and he did this in order to raise the souls of the Jewish people. Let me explain. The first of the Ten Commandments, or the Ten Commandments, begin with the word Anochi. Right? How does the first commandment go? I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt. Right? Anochi Hashem Elokecha. And here you have convergence of everything. Anochi, I, beyond names. Hashem is the four-letter name of God. Elokecha, a lower level, a lower name of God. So God is saying, I am God, your God. Collapsing the entire structure. That itself it requires a deeper analysis. How do we have this convergence of essence and names in one space, in the span of three words? You have two names and the essence. And God is saying basically there's an equivalency there. So how does that work? Again, that's another discussion. But the point for today is that God is saying in the Ten Commandments, according to Kabbalah, I am investing Anochi, my essence, into Torah, into the Ten Commandments, and into the rest of the body of Torah. In fact, Anochi, according to Kabbalah, stands for the Hebrew word Anochi, which is comprised of four letters, Aleph, Nun, Chaf and Yud. Anochi, Aleph, Nun, Chaf, Yud, stands for four Aramaic words. Ana, Nafshi, Ksavis, Yehavis, which is I, my soul, wrote and gave. In other words, God is saying, Torah is my essence being transmitted to you. Torah represents nothing less than God's essence compressed into a readable format. It's the divine essence, Anochi. It's the highest essence of God beyond any names, compressed in a book. It's not just a book, in the Torah that contains God's wisdom and will. But in that is really God's essence. Understand how incredible this is and how revolutionary this notion is. You open up Torah and you can read the stories and you say, well, they're interesting stories, historical stories, stories of creation, stories of a flood, stories of great righteous people, stories of villains, you know, Cain killing Abel and all this other stuff, people, treachery and backstabbing and failure and all this, so much drama. Joseph and being sold as a slave by his own brothers, all of this stuff. And it looks like a dramatic story. And then you have the legal part of Torah, all of the 613 mitzvot and the details of their laws and, you know, this law and that law and Shabbat and holidays and tefillin and mezuzah and all of it, and kosher. And it seems like a very specific, very detailed book. It doesn't seem... You ask somebody, you know, where is God? How do you find God? They probably wouldn't come up with wrapping leather straps around your arm. Right? Or you know, it seems so much lower than the essence of God. Like the essence of God, to connect with the essence of God, you would think would require divestment of all physical activity. It would be like fasting and not speaking. Like, I need a silent meditation where I'm fasting all day, maybe drinking a little bit at night for 7 days, a detox in the desert, right, in a tent, deprivation of the senses, and then I can find God. Because if God is truly stripped of all lowerness, of all relation to otherness, to the universe, if God is truly, if we want to connect with God's essence, so the essence is totally beyond everything, so you would think you have to leave everything else behind. You have to totally leave everything that you know, everything that you feel, everything that defines you as a physical creature to rise up to that essence of God. And yet, Judaism has a completely opposite approach. Judaism says, you want to find the essence of God? Okay. So, number one, you can't. You can't on your own. The only way you can connect with the divine essence is where the divine essence makes itself accessible to you. And where is that? In the Torah. God invests his essence into the Torah and the mitzvot, into the verses of the Torah, into the commandments of the Torah. That is where God's, not where God's names are found, but where God's essence is also found. In other words, if you want to connect with God face to face, see, you need to do the million little things in order to get that connection. You say, yeah, but these things are a distraction. I want a deep connection with God. Where's my meditation? Where's my transcendental experience? How do I get, I want to get up there. You're giving me a list of little things to do, right? Take out the garbage, wash the dishes, right? Shake a lulav and esrog, eat matzah on Passover, right? Buy this food and not that food. You're giving me a list of a million things to do. I don't want to do these things. I want a deep connection. Sometimes you can't have the deeper connection without the little things, especially because we can't have the deeper connection anyway. Because it's the difference, it's a connection between finite and infinite. Good luck bridging that gap on your own. We can't bridge that gap on our own. No matter how transcendent we get, we can't rise to the level of infinity. We just can't. It's not possible. Something finite can't undo itself. Right? So something that's finite can't rise to the level of infinite. The only way this works is because God lifted us up. He reached down with, again, metaphorically, not literally. God doesn't have arms. Lifted down, bent down, took his arms, not literally, right? Picked us up and brought us close to him. And that's the Torah. The Torah seems very mundane, very low. Exactly, it is. It's God lifting down. It's God bending down putting his hands beneath us to lift us up to get close to him. So that's what Torah is. It seems very mundane. You should know this. Without getting too gory, if you walked into the temple, right, the crowning achievement of Jewish life in ancient times, the crowning, this, the epicenter of Jewish life, was the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. If you walked into the Holy Temple in Jerusalem, what would you see? People meditating? People levitating? What would you see? Again, without getting too graphic, it was a Schlachthaus. It's Yiddish for a slaughterhouse. Again, without getting too graphic, sacrifices and offerings were being brought. Very mundane. Somebody would walk in and say, "Are you kidding me? This is your holy place? This is your holy activity?" I'm finding something more spiritual. What is this? Somebody says, "I want to be in love. I want a real loving relationship. I don't want to do any of this mundane stuff. I don't want any of this day-to-day responsibility and interaction. I want love. I want love. Not this, not the nitty-gritty." The answer, the message here is, you can't have one without the other. You can't have the deeper connection without the little things. So the way God set this up is that we have all of these commandments, all of these details. We have a Torah that's filled with what seems to be the nitty-gritty. And in fact, the Talmud says, the rabbis in the Talmud said, that if God would have commanded us to chop wood, we would be wood choppers. So he didn't. So we're not, I mean, we could also chop wood, but it's not a mitzvah. But if God would have said it's a mitzvah every day to chop wood, we would chop wood. So instead of chopping wood, he says it's recite a blessing, light Shabbat candles, you know, give tzedakah, whatever it is. The point is, all of these small details, seemingly mundane physical actions, they're all about creating and building this relationship. So you want to have a deep relationship with God. God says, okay, I'm lifting you up. I'm lifting you up to have a deep connection. And it's going to be by doing the little things. Make sense? Okay, so now let's jump into the next section. Page 42, middle of the page. Day and night. So here we talk about how Torah can lift us out of places of darkness. Man is a microcosm. The human being, in the Hebrew, it's Ha'adam Hu Olam Katan. The human being is a small world. This is not a Disney song. This is a message of what it is to be human. Just as within the larger world there is day and night, the difference between them being that during the day the light shines, as it is written, God called to the light day, while during the night there is an absence of light, as it is written, and to the darkness he called night. The same is true within a person, in a spiritual sense. There is day and there is night. So let's understand this. In the world at large, in the macrocosm, in the universe, in our reality, in our world, we have day and we have night. Day is marked by light. Night is marked by... It's interesting, he doesn't say dark. He says, heder ha'ar, lack of light. He doesn't actually call it darkness, which is an interesting thing. Philosophers have long debated whether darkness is a reality or an absence of reality. We had our JLI class, we talked about evil and darkness, and one of the points that we mentioned is that according to Kabbalah, darkness and evil doesn't have its own energy, is just an absence of positive energy. An absence of light is what we call darkness. But darkness does not have its own energy. And the biggest proof is that in a dark room, the moment you turn on the light, the darkness disappears. It dissipates. It naturally and organically is undone. It doesn't put up a fight. Darkness doesn't say, let me push back. You never had a situation where you had dark and light and the darkness won. It never happened. Right? It's impossible. Because darkness doesn't have its own energy. It's simply an absence of light. The moment you introduce light, so you don't have darkness anymore. Right? Because you have light. It's just waiting for light to be there. So he says like this, in the macrocosm, in the world at large, you have day and you have night. What is day? Day is marked by the presence of light. When there's light, there's day. When there's no light, we call it dark. Or we call it night. Not that there's a force and an energy of darkness, simply an absence of light. Which means that all you need, so he's talking about a person, right? It's not just a theory. It's not just day and night. You know, oh, it's nice. Yeah, 24 hours, day and night. We're talking about a person. There are moments in our lives in which we feel light. We feel the light. We feel spiritual. We feel connected. We feel loving. We feel our soul. We feel God. We feel all of these wonderful things. It's a moment of light. Then there are moments in which we feel night. We feel the darkness. And it's not the darkness itself. It's really an absence of the light. So take a look at this verse, the end of the second to last paragraph. As it is written, though I sit in darkness, God is a light unto me. Though I sit in darkness, God is a light unto me. And what that means is, when a person is in a state of spiritual darkness, a person feels the absence of light. The source of light is coming from God. In other words, the fix to that condition is allowing the divine light to come in. And that divine light, in the context of what we're discussing, it looks like all of the little things that Torah is comprised of. That is the light that illuminates the darkness. So now let's jump into a broader discussion of what darkness is and how that feels to human beings. This physical world is called darkness. Since it is a world, page 44, filled with falsehood and deception. So he says like this, what constitutes the spiritual darkness of the world? In large measure, it's about falsehood and deception. And he draws the analogy between being physically dark and falsehood and deception, which is a spiritual condition of darkness. When it is physically dark, one cannot see anything at all. One may even be oblivious to the fact that he's standing at the edge of a deep pit or near some other dangerous thing. Think about it. When it's dark, you don't recognize the danger that might be right next to you. You might be right next to a pit, or to a snake, or to the edge of a cliff. And you don't know because it's dark. Right? So darkness, what is the challenge of darkness? It's that you might be in danger and you wouldn't even know about it. You're standing right next to danger and you can't identify it. So let's continue. The same is true of this physical world. Why is this world called a world of darkness? Because one cannot be sure of what another person's feelings are toward him. Look what he says. Somebody could be standing right next to you and pretend that they love you or that they're your friend, and really, they're the cliff that you can tumble down, or they're the snake that's ready to bite. Very cynical, but it's a very sobering picture of life and other human beings. Right? This the person may express one type of sentiment with his mouth, yet feel completely different in his heart. The person may honor him with his mouth, speaking to him with words of affection, and yet hate him in his heart. So you could have somebody that face to face, to your face, tells you that they love you. Behind your back, kills your reputation. This is a world of darkness. And a world of darkness is a dangerous world because you don't know the danger that's right next to you. You might be standing next to a landmine. You might be standing right next to a snake. And you wouldn't even know it. So the advantage of light is that it's clear and obvious. You know what they say, keep your friends close and your enemies closer. The enemy that you know, you can deal with. It's the enemy that you don't know, how do you deal with that enemy, right? How do you deal with someone who you think is an ally, right? It's a classic, double agent scenario, right? You think this person is on your side. In truth, they're trying to get you. So now what do you do? So he says, this is just a window of insight. Or this is just one example of how dark our world is. Why is our world called a world of darkness? And in Kabbalah, it's called Amma Deshikra, which is Sheker, is falsehood. It's a world of falsity, a world of falsehood and deception. Why? Because people aren't honest with each other. Simply, people tell people things all the time, and they're not honest about it. Especially in relationships. People misrepresent their agenda and their objectives. Right? People say one thing to get close, and really they mean something else. And they don't have any intention at all in really, in whatever it is that they represented. You have this all the time. Unfortunately. There's a law I once heard former chief rabbi of the UK, Jonathan Sacks, draw this analogy. He says there's a law, one of the halachot, one of the areas of Jewish law, can be called the shopkeeper law. What is the shopkeeper law? So if you are going into a store, you're not allowed to misrepresent yourself and your intentions. If you don't intend to buy, you cannot give the impression to the store owner, to the storekeeper, that you have an intention to buy. Has anybody ever worked retail in selling to somebody else? Yes? Yes? And how does it feel when you think somebody's interested in buying and they have no intention, and you invest energy in that relationship and they have no intention of actually buying? Not that at the end of the story they didn't buy because, whatever. But they never intended to buy. How does that make you feel? Terrible. You just spent 10 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, a day, a year cultivating this relationship. And you thought you knew what was going on. Turns out, they're like, yeah, no. And you realize they were never interested. So how does that make you feel? Not only disappointed, it makes you feel more than disappointed. It's not just you feel used. You feel used. Manipulated. You were used. You thought the relationship, you thought this was one thing. Because they represented themselves as such. They represented themselves as though they were in this sort of relationship. And then they pulled the old rug out from under your feet, right? They pulled the carpet out from under your feet. And you realized they were never, that was a lie. That was a deception. It hurts. So there's a law. Halacha, Jewish law says, you cannot give the impression, verbally or through other means, you cannot give the impression that you're going to buy or that you're serious about buying if you don't intend to buy. It's called deception. Genevat dat. It's stealing the mind. Literally. Genevat dat. Stealing the mind of the other. Deception. fooling someone. So therefore, if you're going to the mall, this is a practical ramification, practical example of this law. If you're going to the mall because you need a pair of shoes, and you go to the shoe store to try on the pair of shoes, but you have no intention of buying, but you ask the salesperson, can we try it? You know, they invest in the relationship, in the customer service, and you give them the impression that they might make the sale. But in your mind, you know that you're going to order it on Amazon. You just need to know which size fits. That's all you need to know. And since Amazon is still virtual, you still can't actually try on the shoe from this. They haven't invented that. I'm sure Bezos is working on it. Some way that you can actually try on stuff, you know, through the internet, whatever. The point is, since you still can't do that, so the mall is your next best bet. If that's your intention, if your intention is not at all to purchase from this store, but you give the salesperson or the owner or whoever it is the impression that that's going to happen, it's called genevadat, straight up stealing the mind, deception. And it's a prohibition. It's a biblical prohibition. You're not allowed to do it. So what do? You can go into the store and say, I don't plan on buying a pair of shoes today from this store. Are you okay? Are you okay with me trying on a pair of shoes? Still, nonetheless. They'll likely say yes, because they think that they can still maybe sell you and convince you on it. And maybe you're still open to doing it. But at least you're representing yourself. You know, I have no intention of buying. I would just like to try it on. I'd just like to browse. But there's no deception, because you're stating your position. But to deceive someone, to make them think that this relationship is about this, when really it's about that, that is straight up deception. Make sense?
It's interesting. When you walk into a store, lots of times someone will come up and ask, may I help you?
Right. Right.
But that's common these days.
It's common. One might argue and say, well, today, salespeople, they know the customer, they know that they're probably not, that they know that, you know, probably that person might not be, they suspect that not every customer that shows interest is really interested. It still doesn't let us off the hook from doing the right thing and represent our intentions honestly. Even when they approach us, and even when we say, if we're just looking, just browsing, it depends on what the expectation. It depends on what, if you're in Best Buy, right? Let's say you need, why are you in Best Buy? You need a, what do you need?
Laptop.
A laptop. You need a laptop computer. Right? Your computer has been slow, and it's like, you hear noises, like it's clicking, and like, oh God, this hard drive is going. I need something quick. Maybe not today, but in the next few days, I need something. So you're like, okay, I'm going to go online. There's a million laptops. Where do I start? Let me go to Best Buy, see what they have on display. Speak to somebody who knows something, you know, maybe, assuming that they know, right? And then from there, I'll figure it out. If it's expensive, I'll look online, you know, while I'm there, I can search, write down some model numbers and figure this out. So you're looking at the display, and they come over to you, can I help you? Jewish law says, be honest, right? Be honest, be upfront. Say, look, I'm in the market for a new laptop. I don't know if I'm going to buy it here or somewhere else, but I'm looking. You know, can you help me? But at least you're giving them the information. The thing that we're not supposed to do is withhold information and or give them false information and thereby mislead them. We're not supposed to mislead other people. So Jonathan Sacks says, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Lord Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, he was knighted. So he says the same thing is true in relationships. It's important not to mislead someone else in a relationship, whether it's a romantic relationship or whether it's a business relationship, right? Don't misrepresent yourself. Right? If you're not interested in a relationship, then don't say you're interested in a relationship. Right? If you're interested in one thing, don't say you're interested in something else. So just be upfront about this, about what the nature of this relationship is. So along the lines of our discussion, this discourse. the world that we live in is a world that's called a Alma de Shikra, world of falsity, falsehood, and deception. Olam HaShaker. Why? He says one of the reasons is because people misrepresent themselves. They speak to you nicely in one way, and really, behind your back, you know, they have a completely different feeling. You should know that when it comes to Joseph, I mentioned in passing before, but it's actually relevant here. So Joseph's brothers, the Torah says, they hated him. It's a very strong language that the Torah uses. Joseph, it says, Joseph's brothers, they hated him. And they hated him to the point that they wanted to kill him. And then when they decided not to kill him, because what does it benefit them, they sold him as a slave for a few bucks. They said, at least let's turn us... If we kill him, we don't gain anything. If we sell him, at least we get some cash. That's how much they hated him. The Torah says they hated him so much, they couldn't speak to him nicely before they sold him. It's, as in the build-up toward that dramatic story of throwing him into a pit and selling him, they say they hated him, Joseph, the brothers hated Joseph, and they couldn't speak to him nicely. Commentaries say that's actually a good thing. Work with me here. It's not good, but it's better. They hated him, and they didn't speak nicely to him. They didn't pretend that they liked him while secretly hating him. They weren't echad bepeh ve'echad belev. They weren't one in mouth, but otherwise in heart. They were, at least they were transparent. Now, it was an ugly emotion. They hated him, but they didn't pretend to like him. That's even worse. I mean, I don't know. I guess that could be argued. But I guess it's worse. I mean, it's pretty bad what they did to him. Hating him and not speaking to him nicely and then wanting to come and then selling him as a slave. I don't know how it could have been. But at least he knew who he was dealing with. So at least they're representing themselves. Darkness means that you don't have that clarity. It means that you think that this person is your friend. You think that they're your ally. You think that you're in a loving relationship. You think they care about you. And then you realize, oh, they don't care about you. All they cared about this whole time was themselves. They only wanted that. So they pretended that they... It's not a relationship. So this is the world that we live in. And this is the darkness that can creep in. So let's continue. Second paragraph, page 44. Thus, this physical world is called darkness, since it is a world filled with falsehood and deception. And whereas the world to come is called the world of truth, Olam Ha'emet, this world is called the world of falsehood. So he says, in the afterlife, right, after we pass away, or after Mashiach comes, whatever, in the hereafter, in the after, you know, in the whatever's after this, so that world is called Olam Ha'emes, the world of truth. This is the world of falsehood. That's the world of truth. What's the difference? It's whether the light is shining or whether the light is out. In this world, the light is out. It's dark. You don't know what's going on. We don't know what's going on in other people's hearts, in other people's minds. It's not clear. There's no transparency. In the future world, it's only transparency. Everything is true. Everything is as it seems to be. That itself is a blessing. To know where you stand, to know where others stand, then you can deal. Then you can proceed. Not knowing where other people stand. What drives us crazy is when we don't know. Right? Or when we think we know and we have an inkling like maybe we don't know. That's what drives us crazy. Can't get the information out of somebody. You can't figure out how they feel. You feel like, you know, I don't really know. Do they really care? Do they really mean this? Do they really want this business? That's what drives us crazy. Once you know, you can deal with it. If you know where somebody is, then you can make a decision. Either I want to be in a relationship with you or I don't want to. Either I want to do business with you or I don't want to. But I know where you're coming from. When I don't know what your motivation is, that's what kills me. I mean, that's what gets us down here.
I remember you saying that Judaism doesn't allow for the expression of anger. How would that tie into this discussion?
Well, so, look, anger is... Who's free of anger? Judaism teaches that we should avoid anger to the utmost extreme. Right? So Maimonides says that when it comes to most emotions, it's good to take the middle ground. Like generosity or, you know, like being very generous or very much withholding. He says, be in the middle. Don't be either extreme is too extremist. Try to be in the middle. Right? Like, but when it comes to anger, he says, go all the way the other way. Run away from anger. Because any anger is very devastating. It's hurtful to one's own self. So anger is not good. When it comes to the brothers of Joseph, they clearly had issues. They had a hate problem. They hated him. And that was wrong. At the same time, they didn't pretend not to be in that state. So at least they were honest with their emotions and they were honest to him. Now, if he chose not to see it, that's one thing. It seems like he was a little bit naive to how they felt about him. And he said, let me check on, his father said, go check on your brothers. And he's like, okay, yeah, let's see what they're up to. Like, they're plotting to kill him, and he's going checking on them. So, and he was younger, right? He was the second to youngest brother then. They were older. So, it seems like he was a little bit of naivete over there in that experience. It's not letting them off the hook with their anger and their hatred. That's not a good emotion. That's a toxic emotion, and it led to devastating results in the story. What the commentaries point out is this simple idea that the Torah emphasizes, that they hated him so much that they couldn't speak to him. You know, lo yochel l'dabro l'shalom. They couldn't speak to him peacefully. That represents a certain sincerity in their hate. Not that they should have it, not that it's a good thing, but at least, you know, the one redeeming factor is they were consistent. They were transparent with that emotion. For what it's worth, it's really not worth much. Like I said, like they still wanted to kill him, and they still sold him as a slave for it. And he was away from home for 22 years. Like that was still a major problem. For what it's worth, they didn't try to hide it too much. I'm not saying the takeaway is not at all that we're justified to hate, and when we hate, we should be open and honest about it, and be very, very, very like above board. Like, listen, you know, let's have a schmooze here. I actually despise you, and I'm very angry. No, that's not the ideal. Obviously, the ideal is not to hate, but the point is here the transparency of feeling. Look, some of us are more open with our emotions by nature. Some of us are more, you know, we wear our heart on our sleeve, and that's either it's nature or it's nurture, that's the type of family we were brought up, whatever, fine. Some of us are more guarded by nature. By nature, we don't share how we feel. We kind of keep our feelings to ourselves, and we keep our thoughts to ourselves, and we only share what we feel safe sharing. Look, you know, are we going to change our natures dramatically? I don't know. But the point is, we can't mislead people. You can't only give information that makes it appear one way when really we're in a completely different place. Even if we're not sharing everything, at least share enough about how we feel about this thing to those people that are affected by that feeling. So if I'm not serious about buying, right, I'm giving a silly example. It's almost like the store example is a silly example. It's not silly if you're working on commission, by the way, but it's silly in the broader scheme of human beings and emotions and relationships. Maybe not silly, but it's like it's a lower, you know, it's a more mundane example, and yet it's instructive because I think it's very concrete. You know, if you're not intending on buying, don't represent yourself as a buyer. You don't have to share all your emotions. You don't have to give the whole story about, you know, all the computers that you've ever owned and the fact that this one is, you know, the noises that it's making. You don't have to share everything. Just say simply, you know, I'm looking, probably not going to buy today, but just looking to see what's out there. That's it, and you're safe.
I was just going to say it's kind of like buying a car. You're going in right. With good intentions, but right. That car may be too noisy or it may not be
correct.
Fit. And I've been in that position before, and I'm just honest with
right.
The salesperson.
But think about the other way. I bought a car before. I knew about the reputation of buying cars. And it was such a draining experience. Anybody have that experience?
Yes.
Just absolutely draining?
Yes.
That's why I like karma.
I haven't tried that yet. I'm telling you, the draining experience of it, I mean, first time I bought a car, Nissan Altima, first car that I ever bought, came down to Atlanta with a 1994 Saturn sedan. Yeah. Remember the Saturn? It used to have that color, that kind of reddish, purplish, whatever. They had their signature color, whatever. 1994. It was owned by my old neighbor in Pittsburgh, who we lived in a duplex. She lived downstairs with her husband. She drove it. It was, I got it in 2004, 10 years later. It had 2,000 miles on it. It was like a new car from 10 years ago. She just drove it around the block, just to the grocery store and back. It was really like never used. So I drove it in New York when I moved here in 2006, 2007. So we drove it down here. And we had to buy a second car. So we bought a car. It was such a harrowing experience. It's like, okay, you see the price and you're like, okay, let's negotiate. You think the negotiation is to get the price a little bit down. Oh, then it starts. Then it starts. A whole day. A whole day. I need to go back in to speak to this guy and to that guy. And they come back and they write things on paper. It's like, why? We're having a conversation. You're coming back with a piece of paper. What's I'm in a warp here. What's happening? And like, oh, and then you go to the finance and you realize like it's three times the price. It's like, what happened? It's like, whoa, we weren't counting. That's the this and then this. Of course there's the that. It's like, oh my God, are you kidding me? It works both ways is my point. And so there's representing yourself as a buyer, a prospective buyer. But how much... Life would be so much easier if in that experience everybody represented themselves honestly. It's like, here's the price. It's like, here's the price. Here's the price with a few financing options. And this is the price. And it's just there. And it's just there. Life would be so much easier. It's like, either I can afford it or I can't afford it. Or I'll look at another car. That's it. So just tell me that. Put me in the ringer for a whole day? It's like, I have to pick up my kids. It's like, oh yeah, you can come back. If 7 o'clock at night, it's a whole day. Yeah. I feel like I'm burdening my soul here. I feel like open.
The deception should go both ways.
Yes.
I got that.
Yes.
Just following through on the car idea. What would you say about going shopping for a Rolls Royce when you absolutely know? Not that you might not buy it, but you're curious what it's like. But there's no way that I'm.
It's fine. It's fine. It's perfectly. But tell them though that you just want to check it out. It's like, I've never seen a Rolls Royce.
Yeah.
They're fine with that. I mean, I don't know. Right. Not like I've ever done that, but they might be fine with that.
And as long as you're.
Yeah, you could.
Then
it's no problem.
They might still say, well,
I can
if he
still,
drives it around, maybe he'll do it.
I'm a good enough salesman. I can sell a Rolls Royce to someone that can't afford it.
Oh,
they
yes.
might say that.
Yes.
And that's fine. Or not fine. I don't know. But that's on them. But the main thing is that you represent yourself honestly. And again, it doesn't mean you have to share the whole story about your finances.
It would be wrong to say,
I'm considering it. Correct.
That would be still deception.
Ganevata. That's deception. Straight up deception. If you don't intend on buying the Lamborghini or the Rolls Royce or the Jack, whatever it is, then don't represent yourself as being in that market. Say that, you know, you drove by, you've always been wanting to check it out. You know, can I take a look? You know, are you up to a test drive if it's not busy? They might say, sure. And the salesperson might say, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow. But, you know, when the next check comes in or the next raise comes in, maybe I'll have this person as a customer to take care of them. They very likely will say that. And that's cool. That's fine. But you're representing yourself honestly. So again, this idea... Yeah. The Four Agreements is a book. It's interesting you mentioned the Four Agreements. Hold on. Somebody gave me a copy of the Four Agreements. So Tom Brady, didn't we discuss this?
Yeah,
I've read it too. Yeah, Tom Brady. You know Tom Brady,
mm-hmm.
Quarterback. So I learned this about him. I think when he was serving his suspension, four games. Was that the beginning of the last year or 2 years ago?
2 years ago.
I think it was 2 years ago. For Deflategate. So he was serving the four-game suspension and whatever, so he was like, you're reflective and everything. So it came out that his favorite book to keep him centered and focused, The Four Agreements, being honest. It's interesting because you think of him as just like an athlete and whatever, but he's very... there's a lot of baggage with Tom Brady. Like, there's a lot of stuff. People hate him, people love him, whatever. I'm not getting into Tom. I'm not a Tom Brady fan. I'm just saying that I found it cool that he was very... reading up about him, like how much he cares about like the emotional and psychological piece of it, I thought was very interesting. That here you have a world-class athlete who you might think is just caring about like body and repetition and practice and the physical stuff, and he's really taking the deeper stuff, the spiritual stuff, the psychological stuff seriously. I thought that was very impressive in general. But yeah, Four Agreements. Number one is Levonously.
Keep your word,
Levonously, and it's the antidote to the world of darkness that we live in. The larger context here, which we'll get back to in our next session, the larger context here is how Torah, how God provides the light in a world of darkness. But of course, there's a lot that each of us can do to be more honest and to shine a little bit more light in this place of darkness. Let's recap what we did today. What we did today is, crystallize the notion of how to build a deeper relationship. To have any relationship, a deeper relationship, you cannot just jump to the depth. You can't just jump in and say, well, you know, we're married, so we should be connecting on a deep level. I'm your parent, so we should have a deep connection. You're my child. That's the same thing. I'm your parent, you're my child. You're my parent, so we should have a deep relationship. Nothing happens automatically. If you want something deep, it's a product of doing all of the little things to build up to that place. So it's doing what seems like the millionth, and it may seem like minutia, like the little thing, like I have to do this for that, and the answer is yes. The truth is, as the Rebbe explains in his explanation on this discourse, it's not deceptive. It's not that you're doing this to get that. It's that even in the small thing, you're revealing and you're expressing your love. Just to tie the two points together. You're not deceiving the students by telling them a joke to rope them in, aha, and then hit them with the teaching. It's not deception. It's consistent with your goal, which is to create a connection. It's consistent. The joke is not deception. Picking up the child is not deception. You want to play with them, so why are you picking them up? It's deception. You're doing the dishes, right? You're doing the dishes so that there's a feeling of closeness, so that, et cetera, et cetera. So it's deceptive. It's not deceptive. It's not deceptive. Because even in the small action, you're being honest and you're connecting. And the point is that it's the little connections that foster, that pave the way for the deeper connection. So we should invest the work in the little stuff, because it's the little stuff that makes the big stuff a reality. Thank you very much for joining me today, this morning, for Kabbalah and Coffee.